views and opinions expressed by hosts, invited speakers, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views and opinions of the Black Talk Media Project or the Black Talk Radio Network.
Host of tonight's show on Race Treaty. While many of you may be home, relaxing, enjoying the evening, there is a tradition being continued. That is the Black Radical tradition. And people are converging in the city of so-called Brotherly Love, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, at the popular Temple University to discuss what that tradition is, what it's been, and even where it's going to go. And tonight, we are truly, truly blessed to have with us in that discussion not only a participant of the conference tonight, but one of the co-founders of this modern radical Black tradition. He is a co-founder of the Radical Radical Congress. So to the audience, let me introduce to some and to reintroduce others, Brother Sam Anderson. Excuse me, I have a cold. I wasn't there today because I was under the weather, and going out at night just makes it worse. So if you hear me coughing like that, you know that it's something that's beyond my control. I'll just try to do my best to eliminate it if I can. But Brother Sam, welcome to Race Treaty.
Thank you. Good evening. And I was one of many people who were co-founding the Black Radical Congress.
That's true. I did say co-founder. So yes, we are indeed in agreement. And for those of you who are listening for the first time, Race Treaty comes on every Friday between 9 and 10. And we try to point the discussion in the direction of ICERD. ICERD is the International Convention to Eliminate Racial Discrimination. That was, what, 68, 69? And that this country has signed on to as ratified, which means this is part of our law system. The principles of equity, of justice, of fairness, and certainly we know that is not the case in terms of actuality, in terms of practice. We say that there's things that happen through de jure and things that happen through de facto. So the de facto reality is that we are an oppressed nation from the time of our captivity, our transport, our terrorization, and our domination, where we became domesticated. And the Black radical tradition has always been here because it's been our fight against our captivity. It's been a fight against our oppression. That Black radical tradition has always been here, servicing, moving in and out and around in the way that it could for our survival and, in fact, for our self-determination. So, as I had said earlier, we are blessed to have with us one of the co-founders of the Black radical tradition. So, Brother Sam, maybe you can give us a little background. How did the Black Radical Congress come about?
As you stated, the Black Radical Tradition is as American as apple pie. The struggle in the 1980s and early 90s was transformative in the Black community because of the generational and ideological shift that happened, where a lot of the activity, a lot of the radical activity among Black folks got subdued or neutralized through COINTELPRO, and our conditions as a people were worsening. And so, to make a long story short, a number of people started to come together initially as a response to the more conservative, Black conservative trend that was evolving via the Nation of Islam, and a more or less misreading of the Million Man March. And so the initial organizers of the Black Radical Congress saw that there needed to be an oppositional voice to the more conservative voice that was beginning to take shape and have prominence within the Black community across America. And so in their response, they put together a body, and said that because of the conservative force, we want a radical, oppositional force. But what they meant by radical in the initial stages was liberal, not radical / Black nationalist / revolutionary, kind of thing. And so when they put the call out for, a meeting in New York City for, help to form, the Black Radical Congress, and, when people met at Columbia University, I believe it was in December of 97. I know it was December, but I believe it was 1997 when we met. The leader, the originators of the call were in shock because what came together were all these, as you know, in out of New York, traditional Black nationalist forces, Garveyites and revolutionary nationalists, Republican New Africa, you name it. And then also independent Black communists, you know, also showed up. And all the other meetings that they had in different cities, they didn't have this kind of mix. And so, it meant that from its inception, the Black Radical Congress was problematic. In other words, you had people who thought of radicalism as a word to use to be oppositional to the growing conservatism and a reaction to Farrakhan. And then you had a group of people who saw Black radicalism as being part of the traditional Black nationalist, revolutionary nationalist, and left, Black left kind of movement. And so that's how, in a nutshell, how it began. And when we met in, I believe it was in May, I think it was, in Chicago in 98, we had to work out from the early stages how to balance this dynamic, this dilemma of the more conservative or liberal, I should say, forces who consider themselves radical, and the more radical forces in various tracts who consider themselves radical. And so that's how it began.
So I would imagine that the listening audience would say, if that's how it began, how has it transpired? I mean, have you been successful in terms of holding those two, for lack of a better analogy, opposite ends together?
No. The Black Radical Congress more or less died on the vine about 6 or 7 years after its inception. Because one of the reasons is because of that. of that tension that they couldn't hold. Another was because of the ideological baggage that some of the elder folks brought into the Congress, you know, arguments from 30 years prior and so forth brought into the Congress, it alienated the young folks. We had in 98, at least one third of the attendees were people under 35 and under, which was fantastic. But they weren't into the internecine, ongoing internecine warfare among the old heads. And the other problem that existed in that early stages with the young folk was that they were not integrated into every aspect of the development of the organizational development of the Congress. The error was that the youth as youth were pulled together into a group and therefore not integrated into the full structure of the Black Radical Congress. We were looking at the youth, as opposed to how, for example, SNCC and the Black Panther Party people saw themselves. Yes, we are young people, but we are also very much part of the broader aspect of the revolutionary struggle. That was not part of that. So you had the immediate alienation and distancing of the youth component within the Black Radical Congress. The other factor was the tension or the positive tension and development of the women issues around women and gay and lesbian, bisexual, etc. That was very much part, like the youth, very much part of the organizational structure, but in terms of the being integrated into the leadership of the organization, that was problematic, and that created some tensions too. But I think those are the mainly three factors of why the Black Radical Congress did not sustain itself.
Okay. So, now I'm getting a better understanding. So the Black Radical Congress actually, at some point didn't exist any longer. It was totally dissipated. And then from that came another movement.
The present thing that's happening here in Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Black Radical Tradition, as it's called, is more of a conference to assess, to introduce some of the young folks to some of the history of the Black Radical Tradition, and to make suggestions on how to move forward. It is not at this stage a organization forming body. It is more of a conference.
Okay, got it. That's good to know. Got it. So, with that, you mentioned something that some of our people in the listening audience might not have heard before or to have the full extent, but it's important for me to go back to one of your remarks, because if people don't understand what it is, what it was, and how it continues, they will wind up blaming the victim by transferring the so-called lack of progress of our people and placing that blame on the people without, in fact, understanding the context and the forces, the alien forces against them that keeps them us in that static state. I'm talking about COINTELPRO. You talk about the counterintelligence program. Not maybe some of our audience may not know what that is. What is that, and how, and what relationship does it have to Black people in our movement for liberation?
In order to talk about the counterintelligence program and to make sense of it, we need to go back to 1918-1919, when black troops were coming back from World War I, fighting in Europe. The black troops were fighting for democracy, and when they went to fight in Europe, they could not fight with the whites in the U.S. Army. They had to, they were forced to fight with the French, because of the U.S. Army was so segregated. And this really was an eye opener for tens of thousands of brothers who went over there to fight. And so they come back 1918-1919. And as you know, that was a period of serious lynching happening all over the United States. And these black soldiers came back, young men, knowing how to fight. They said, no, we ain't taking this. And so it was the whole movement that was created, a radical movement called the New Negro Movement, which was the precursor to the Harlem Renaissance and the development of the Garvey Movement, because Marcus Garvey came in around in this same period, came to the United States. So you had this radical movement where these young black men, veterans for the most part, were not going to take anything from no white folks again. And Congress was split. Congress being predominated by the Southern Cracker, forces, they were flipped out. And they read into the congressional record a documentation of the new Negro movement, and particularly one cartoon, that showed, a demonstration in Harlem where black men were in a Model T, and they had rifles all over the place. Nothing but rifles just showing all over, you know, and a banner saying the new Negro. This forced, the security apparatus in the United States to do something. The young J. Edgar Hoover was part of a, new, investigative body, a state run called the Federal Bureau. Not yet the FBI. But soon after it became the FBI, and he became head of it, and his goal was to crush criminal and radical elements. And so he went after, in the early 1920s, he went after the radical blacks that he could think of all over the place. The African Blood Brotherhood, Marcus Garvey, you name it, you know, the NAACP. He went at them, you know, harassed them, infiltrated the groups, and so forth. So this laid the foundation for some 40 years later, when the rise of black militancy happened again, coming out of the civil rights movement, some 40 years later, for the national security state in the United States, but through the FBI and the CIA, to find a way to counter this radicalization, to criminalize the forces, to, as they would say, neutralize them, and so forth. And so there was the creation of the counterintelligence program, COINTELPRO, whose specific purpose was to destroy, any semblance of a black radical movement. And as they would say in the text, any semblance of a black messiah, any major leader like Martin Luther King or Malcolm X, if they killed Malcolm X in 65, that was their first, day, meaning COINTELPRO, their first, quote unquote success. They killed him. 3 years later, they killed, Martin Luther King. In the meanwhile, they infiltrated, undermined, destroyed people's, black people's lives all over the country in all of the different groups, the Black Panther Party, the Republican New Africa, you name it. You know, they were in and out. The early stages of the Black Studies programs, they had spread rumors, forced, universities to fire blacks and so forth. So the counterintelligence program was, and is, they have a new formation now under the Patriot Act, a body.
All right, listeners, Pierce, we're having some technical difficulties. Bear with me. See if we can get everybody back.
Hello.
Seems like we got cut off somehow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we're back. Please continue.
All right. So, for those of you who are just listening in, this is Race Treaty. I am your host, Onaje Muid, tonight. And we have a dear brother who's been part of our people's movement since, I don't know, probably he popped out from the very beginning and was saying Black Power. Sam Ennis.
1964 was my entree into the movement.
Mm. Okay, but you was a part of the SNCC movement?
Yes, and I was a student at Lincoln University, and it was in that period that we joined the local NAACP and helped to desegregate a movie theater in Wilmington, Delaware. That was my inauguration.
Wow!
It was a success.
Sam, what did you study at Lincoln?
When or what?
What?
Oh, mathematics.
Okay. So, you know, he's a rare breed, you know, Black man studying mathematics. So, you know, so folks on the line, you know, we did it with a good brother right here. So, for those of you before we got interrupted, we were talking about COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, and, its beginnings back in the early part of the 1900s, 1918, 1919 after World War One. Black men coming back from France and saying, we're not taking this. So, excuse me for that cough. Sam, you're about to say something?
Yeah, I was going to say it was called the Red Summer because it was rebellions happened all over the place and repression happened in that period. And don't forget, just a couple of years later, the bombing of Black Wall Street. You know, some of these businessmen in Black Wall Street out in the Midwest were veterans, and they came back. They were successful, and the state apparatus bombed the community, and all of that feeds in. All of those things feed into the development of this national security state apparatus vis-a-vis Black people. You know, how do we contain, how do we neutralize, how do we destroy the radicalization of young Black folks?
Now, what you have pointed out is that we are in a very different time period as far as what the linear trajectory has been. And what I'm saying is that the same way in which those Black soldiers coming back from World War One, and we can continue that to say World War Two, we can even go up to Vietnam, and we can go even further to the Civil War from our engagement in the science of warfare. We inherited, ingested it, and then we made it part and parcel of who we were as a people and, of course, brought it to the surface of our movements. Now, the brothers coming back from Afghanistan, coming back from Iraq, some kind of way it doesn't seem to have carried that tradition. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't see that. I see a great departure from that to now, and as a result of the lack of benefit. Now, of course, we already have so much in terms of the cost, because anytime a brother goes off a war, he's away from his family, the families break up, we know about the suicides, we know about the homicides, so there have been collateral damages just by being socialized to be a killer that way. So we've incurred the damages, but it seems, so this is the first time in our people's history we're not, in fact, enjoying the whatever benefits we could commit. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes, there is. It is. And I think one of the major factors in this is that when we look back at all of those places, all those times you mentioned, the Civil War, the World War One, World War Two, Vietnam War. The soldiers coming back, or the soldiers at war, there was a social movement happening, right? There was a social movement happening among Black people in the United States that was informing them. And so when they returned, they returned to a social movement and helped to advance that social movement in that period to a higher degree. The Black Reconstruction period was probably our most power-filled period. I'm using the word power-filled, F-I-L-L-E-D, because we were in positions of political power and in some places of economic power. So there was that social movement that was informing the vets who were coming out of the Civil War. The anti-lynching movement of the 1900s was the key thing that began to inform the young brothers that were coming back from World War One, and you know, they're coming back, you know, they supposedly fought for democracy, and they see lynching, you know, all over the place, and they weren't going to take that. Similarly, in World War Two, you had veterans, my father was a vet, coming back, supposedly fighting for democracy, and being faced with racism smack in the face. My father, an example, he was an officer in the military, and one of his first tasks to come back was to transport German prisoners of war from New York City to Des Moines, Iowa, by train. And when they stopped in Bowling Green, they had the Germans get off and eat. It is the all Black patrol, right? They're all Black. And they had to get off and have the Germans eat in the restaurant, and they put them on the train, and their soldiers went in to eat. And the guy in the restaurant said, "We don't serve niggas." This is after they fed the enemies of the United States, right? These prisoners. And so my father was enraged, and he said, he lined up his soldiers, and he said, "You see those carbines, and you see my 45? If you don't feed us, you don't have a restaurant." So, I mean, people had to face that on a daily basis. Getting on a bus in Alabama with your uniform on and sitting in the bus in the front, and getting harassed and beaten up by white people because you are a Black man in a uniform sitting in the front of the bus, you know, that kind of thing. So that they were ready for the next level of the civil rights movement. They were prepared, they meaning the World War II vets. And similarly with Vietnam, the brothers and now sisters who went to Vietnam, they went to Vietnam in the midst of the civil rights movement and in the later stages in the midst of the Black Power movement. And that kept them informed there. The Vietnamese, the National Liberation Front kept them informed, saying, you know, why are you coming over here to fight when you don't have freedom at home? Many of them returned ready to be engaged in some sort of movement, some sort of organization. And many of them joined the Black Panther Party or the Republican New Africa or some other radical group when they return. So there's that tradition. But the other thing that I wanted to say is that the counterintelligence program, some elements of it, it's not just the FBI, but it was the CIA, the whole, what they call national security state involved. Some elements of it were very sophisticated, very knowledgeable of Black culture, Black particularities, and so forth, and began to use positive black cultural references to undermine positive black cultural references. For example, the you know, John Coltrane's music, Miles Davis's music was used as a way of attracting some of the more young, open-minded brothers and sisters to false radical groups to entrap them and get them arrested and put in jail. And that happened in, all over the country. Very similar to what we see happening today with a lot of the Muslim community in terms of entrapment. So we see this development of the counterintelligence program morphing into the post Patriot Act security state stuff that we see that we are experiencing now.
And for the younger generation, the thing which I want to bring to your attention is that we were very careful about our information and who we gave it to and how freely it was exposed in public. And with this explosion of social media,
right,
it's like you put everybody and your mama and your cousin who's going to be born next year as a public geopolitical map. And we would have never done this 20, 30, 40 years ago. It would have been absurd for us to even think of this. So now you have this accelerated concentration of wealth, which only can lead to one thing, fascism. You have this now this expanded technological web where information is being accessible. You couple that with national security in terms of spying on people and everything else, it creates the perfect equation for dominance and control.
And you left out one ingredient, the dumbing down of of the youth.
And with that, I think it also therefore shows the historical significance of this conference to take place now. Because as you know, in the last year or so, we've had over 75 campus rebellions calling for the removal of the chancellor or the president or some programs or policies that were disproportionately negative and adverse consequences against the black students there. So over 75 colleges. And I'm sure that in your audience, you have some of those students at the conference.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. They're there. They were there. Definitely. And if people want to see those demands, there's a website called thedemands.org that they can see that, all of those demands in detail, you know, and one of the, couple of interesting things about this is that, most of the demands include the, demand to have more black faculty on the campuses, on campuses, you know. That's one interesting thing. And the other is what colleges are missing in this. HBCUs. So far, I have not seen one historically black college listed in the set of demands. And that's very telling. Very telling.
So, this whole thing of separate but equal. I don't know how separate it is if you're using the values and the worldview of your oppressor. And right. Then you get actually pacified to the point where you don't even want to have anything. You don't even have anything to articulate about yourself in terms of self-determination. So that is That is a quite sad commentary that you have brought to our attention. But what are the goals of this convention for the listeners who are maybe just coming in? You said some of that in the beginning, but I want to bring that up again. What are the goals of this convention?
The Black Radical Tradition gathering at Temple University is about linking, and tonight was a clear example of that, about linking young people, young generation, the 35 and under, to the tradition, to the Black Radical Tradition, and laying out what is the Black Radical Tradition. And that was done very, very well by Tony Montero and Cornel West. Lay that out to show that link and the importance of that link. And the second is to hear from, and this is going to happen, mainly tomorrow, to hear from the younger forces that are out here, the Dream Defenders, the Black Lives Matter, the students on the campuses making these demands, you know, all of those different, young forces, to hear from them and to begin to see how they envision, the future. And then the third part, is to, begin the discussion about how organizationally we can move, out of this conference, this gathering. Tomorrow is a lot of things to choose from in terms of topics and so forth. I think that people need to, much of it is going to be, live stream, I think that, you know, people should not worry about not being in one place instead of the other, because they'll be able to get a lot of that, analysis and information, later on from the live stream.
So those who aren't in a position to be in Philadelphia at Temple University tomorrow for the second day, and then, or even the third day on Sunday, you can actually go to your computer and type in www.theblacktradition.org. That is www.theblacktradition.org, O-R-G, and you will be able to participate in the live streaming of the conference. So
the Black. You left out the word radical.
Oh my goodness! It's a Black Radical Tradition.
Right.
Thank you so much. I can't blame it on Henny, but I can blame it on my cold. So this is quite encouraging, because there's been such a low in our people's movement for so many years, with small, you know, things happening here and there, but the connection between the generations is certainly the solution. No generation can do it by itself. It takes the community, not only to the village to raise a child, but it takes a community to lead a movement and to sustain a movement. So I do have some very high hopes and aspirations from what I've been able to listen to tonight on the live streaming and from this conversation. Any let us know some of the speakers and some of the workshops. Give us an idea of what the workshop landscape looks like.
One of the things that I want to point out to folks is that the I'm part of a group called the Black Left Unity Network, which has taken up a lot of the trends that existed in the Black Radical Congress, the radical trends there, taken that up from 2008 to the present. And we're part of this gathering, and we're going to be meeting tomorrow to regroup in terms of doing organizational regrouping. And we have, if people are interested, we have a draft manifesto for Black Liberation, meaning the draft, meaning that people can join in on drafting this thing, this manifesto. But I know time is short. But tomorrow, we have tomorrow there's several panels, five panels. Well, yeah, three panels and three people's assemblies kind of thing. War, Peace, and Global Justice: Resistance to the U.S. Empire. Another panel on neoliberalism, spatial denomination, meaning gentrification, and the struggle to resist the new urban strategies. Temple is famous for that. Columbia University is famous. The University of Penn, you know, you name it. Black women in the Black radical tradition, challenging white supremacy, the Black radical view, and police, prisons, and the neoliberal state. Then there's a march against gentrification, starting, oh, it's a night march, isn't it? 9:30 in the evening, march, against gentrification. They had a march today, in the afternoon. And then, on Sunday, there are more panels, and there is an assembly, people's assembly, the Souls of Black Folk, Art, Culture, and Emancipation of Humanity that starts at 3:00 on Sunday. So there's a lot. People can go online to get all of the details, the blackradicaltradition.org and get those details. For those who are interested in the Black Left Unity Network, people can email me, blackeducator@mac.com, and I can then send them the links to the journal, our webpage, our blog, and the blog it has the draft manifesto. Okay?
Excellent. Now, one thing that stood out for me in terms of the speakers, and it was two basically, and of course the young sister who was the moderator, was that the question of genocide was brought up.
Yeah.
And Tony Montero.
Yeah, Tony Montero.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. He gave the definition, and it was W.E.B. Du Bois and William Patterson, as well as Paul Robeson, who presented the United Nations with the charge of genocide back in 1951, 52.
Right.
And currently there is a call for where is that report, under whose desk, and for it to be, all the dust be blown off it and be updated. This is happening in context to what is called the United Nations Decade of African People from 2015 to 2024, and also connected to this time period is what is called Working Group of Experts on African Peoples, and France Fanon's daughter is the chair of this working group. They're coming to America actually this month in January. They're coming to New York, Chicago, Baltimore, Jackson, Mississippi, to hear from people around what is the experience in terms of this country, and how, and what are the violations in, with respect to America signing on to the International Convention to Eliminate Racism. So things seem to be, as they say, the stars seem to be aligned in terms of what the people are doing, in terms of young people, in terms of the movement coming from the ground up, what veteran organizers and activists like yourself are doing in terms of creating a forum to bring the traditions and the young people together. and even so much to say that whatever we can get from the international community seems to be all aligning at the same time. So this is a very, very crucial period of what is to know. None of this was like coordinated. This all just came, just fit together, because you can't influence the UN body to do something at this time or that time. But we have to, I would believe, take all the work that we're doing and fold it into the Decade of African People, which is the international event, and make sure that Black people not only here in America or in Turtle Island or here in the Americas, but Black people around the world, in fact, are part of that, because the conditions that one of us is suffering here is quite similar to conditions that we're suffering someplace else. You know, in terms of, excuse me, oppression, in terms of being kicked off the land, in terms of not having a housing, you know, a safe place to live, not having clean water, not having enough nutrition. We are starving. We are homeless. Many of us are trying to escape this hell in terms of using drugs. So it's a worldwide phenomenon that we're working against, because racism, that is the international idea that one group is superior and they have the power to and control over another group to exploit their labor, is acceptable. We're saying it's not acceptable. So I want to thank you on behalf of our people and our ancestors, the work that you're doing, Sam, and have been doing, you know, all the years that I've known you, and how you've put together this conference at this time that is pivotal, truly, truly pivotal. And certainly we look forward to having you and maybe some of the organizers come back on Race Treaty Radio, which is every Friday at 9, at some time in the future where you can give us a report back about how that's going, and maybe we can even make that a monthly type of report to the people.
Right. I think it would be good, you know, some of the youthful organizers like that sister who's a keynoter, there, you know, I think it would be good to hear her voice, because she's from Philly, North Philly, organizing in this thing. I think that there'd be a much better voice than mine, who's, you know, non-Philadelphia.
Well, it's a national movement, truly international, so it's not, it just happens to be in Philly. And it was nice to hear Cornel Wells bring up he brought up two names, radical, Black radical traditionists in the 1800s, whose name escapes me right now.
You're talking about Henry Highland Garnett.
Yes. Yes. So it was good to hear that. So give your information again one more time, so the listening audience, if they didn't have a chance to write it down the first time, they can write it down now to get in touch with you and be connected to this movement.
My email is blackeducator@mac.com. M-A-C.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Well, Sam, I want to thank you so much for the impromptu request. That you were able to honor that request after your travels from New York to Philadelphia and still have to get settled for tonight. Thank you for foregoing your dental engagement to be on the call. We appreciate it. So we want you to get fed and nourished so you can hit the deck tomorrow bright and early and running. Thank you so much, Sam, for the interview. We look forward to further reports. And to our listening audience, we thank you for listening in. Please spread the word about the show, about the conference, and how do we get our people free. Good night, everyone.
Good night.
Whoa. Oh, mercy, mercy me. Oh, things ain't what they used to be now. Where did all the blue skies go? Poison is the way that flows from the north and south and east.